Physics World.
Hello, thanks for joining us for another episode of Physics World Weekly. I'm James Dacey, and coming up today, we've got a special extended interview with the cosmologist, Jo Dunkley. Her new book, Our Universe, An Astronomer's Guide, brings some of the biggest questions in physics to a general audience, such as, what is space? Are we alone in the universe? And what lies beyond our current laws of physics? Speaking of people unafraid of tackling the big questions within strict word counts, I'll also be joined by several other members of the Physics World journalism team. They'll be talking about the latest research news headlines, also what's included in the February issue of Physics World. Plus, we'll have an update on the festive jumper competition that we discussed on this show just before Christmas. That's Christmas sweaters, to those of you who've got no idea what I'm talking about. So let's start then with the first part of that discussion I had with Jo Dunkley last Friday. Jo's a cosmologist at Princeton University in the US, but she's from the UK originally, and she was back here to catch up with some of her collaborators and give some talks about the new book. I started by asking Jo if she found it challenging to condense the entire history of the universe into fewer than 300 pages.
Well, I knew I couldn't do it all, but I did want to give an overview, you know, a picture of where we are in our bigger universe and how we came to be here over time in this bigger history we have. So, of course, I can't describe everything in detail, but one thing I think is kind of remarkable is that we've come to this point as astronomers where we can talk about broad brush pictures of the whole thing and its whole history.
Yeah, so I'm reading it at the moment. I'm really, really enjoying it. And it's even though it's covering some very complex ideas, it's written in a very accessible fashion, and there's a distinct lack of equations, for example.
That was very intentional. Yeah. No, I think that
Who is the target audience? Who do you have in mind?
Well, the people I had in mind, actually, and I had this sort of explicit in mind, was friends of mine from university who didn't study science and who probably hadn't studied science since GCSE. So no A-levels, no science degree, but an interest, a curiosity. And I think particularly in this topic, I mean, in many scientific topics, there's a curiosity about knowing what's out there and what's going on, but not a desire to have all the equations or see the details. And so I think that's, you don't need the complicated maths and the complicated equations to get the bigger concepts. So yeah. I really did try and take those out.
Yeah, because I think some people maybe they just have a memory of science from school as a bunch of equations and facts. And sometimes maybe they've made their mind up that they don't like science. So it's great that we've got these kind of books that can bring people back in, hopefully.
Hopefully. I mean, that's the thing. I think that to me, I mean, being a scientist means asking questions and then figuring out how to answer them. And the questions themselves don't have, equations in them. I mean, the way that you answer them, it will then have some details that are perhaps more complicated when you come to the nitty-gritty. But this bigger picture of a scientist just wanting to find out the answer to big questions and then figuring out how to do so is, I think maybe we don't give out that impression enough to, younger people. That's what being a scientist is.
Definitely, yeah. So, I mean, so you're covering all sorts of ideas. As a cosmologist, I guess you're used to kind of blending different theories, and you're talking about gravitational waves and black holes and neutrinos. So was there a particular thing you found especially challenging to basically explain in simple terms?
I think that... the thing that's always a huge challenge, because it's a challenge for us as scientists, is the beginning of the universe. And I tried to get there only later on, right? I thought we won't start with the beginning of the universe, because that's, it's a pretty unfamiliar place. And it's it's very different to how the universe is now. So this concept of there being a beginning of the universe and also how space itself behaves, it is hard, and I tried to come up with ways of imagining what, an expanding universe would look like and how we can picture it, even if, as an analogy rather than necessarily the reality of it.
So with some of the analogies that you do use, are they analogies you've developed over years of teaching physics, or are they things you've devised just for the book?
A mixture of things. So many of the things, it's in the book, is that there's this amazing history of from science educators for a long time of developing ways of simplifying concepts. So some of the things that are in there, I taught to some science teachers about 10 years ago in a course that we developed working with NASA educators. So people who, you know, were whose job it is to figure out how to simplify things. And a number of the concepts were things that we then further refined and developed for teaching teachers. And they're things that I've used in public lectures for the last decade or so. But, you know, the idea of one of the things is I think about scaling down successive realms of the universe into manageable size spaces, you know, thinking about the solar system and the galaxy and the bigger universe. And that's certainly come from something that people at NASA have been doing for years, this idea of scaling down big things to get a grasp of them.
So was it challenging, you know, removing the equations? You mentioned that you deliberately didn't include them. So presumably that process was a bit difficult at times.
Actually, do you know what that, it wasn't. Because to me, once I have someone in my head who I know would not appreciate an equation, I don't feel the need to put it in. At no point did I think, oh, I really want to write an equation down here. Because I knew that that wasn't, in the same way that if I would be speaking to a public audience who I know have not studied science at a higher level, I wouldn't dream of putting an equation in. So I think that that's it's true that when we're working as scientists, that's the language we use. We use the language of maths, but I still think that having a visual picture can describe things, you know, as well as maths if we're thinking about it on a kind of big picture level.
I suppose. In terms of pictures, astronomy has a bit of an advantage over some other areas of physics in these amazing pictures from telescopes like Hubble. And also, I guess, the fact that you're dealing with these epic questions about the meaning of, you know, existence. But do you have any, as an experienced science communicator and teacher, do you have any general tips for other researchers that want to get into more science communication and potentially writing a bit? Any tips in terms of taking research and turning it into a great story for readers?
Oh, yeah, I think that's, I think a tip would be very clear on who your audience is and have them in your head. You know, if you're trying to explain stuff that, you know, school kids will understand, really, you know, imagine having a school kid in front of you and try describing your science to them. And that's something that, But to get practice at that, the way that I practiced this is I went and talked to a lot of school kids. So that's been kind of my past experience as a scientist. It's ever since I started my PhD, I regularly, you know, went to talk to school kids and you know, gave talks to the public. And so I wasn't necessarily that good at it to begin with, or didn't have the feeling of what the level should be, but. You know, I guess I've got better at it. But I do think I think for someone starting out, that would be my suggestion, would be, you know, just go into a classroom and ask kids to raise their hands and ask you questions. Because they will have questions.
Yeah, sure. There's probably some very intelligent ones.
Absolutely. Exactly. Yeah. Probably better than the grown-ups. Yeah. And then to begin with, you know, some things might come out a bit jargony. Yeah, and I think that's a real... It is a challenge, I think, as scientists, of constantly thinking, is that word, you know, is that word jargon? Is that word a word something people will understand?
So I mean, a lot of people, you know, say to their friends down the pub or whatever, they're going to write a book, but it's one of the things saying it and actually sitting down and doing it. So what's your approach to writing? Are you a morning person, or do you just try and squeeze it in wherever possible?
I had to do it in a quite... a concerted effort where I would try and write a certain number of words each day, but I had to kind of fit it around the rest of my research job. So I would typically, when I was heavily, you know, working on it, I would write for perhaps a couple of hours each day, either at night after my, you know, daughter was in bed, or, you know, the before or after work, or the end of the work day, where I'd often leave my office and maybe go and write in a cafe or something. I couldn't write in my regular, regular work
change
office.
Change of scenery, different places.
Different scenery, yeah. But I also found it very helpful to have, I mean, a whole book is too much to try and do all at once. So I had, you know, broke it down, of course, into chapters and had deadlines for those.
Yes.
In the same way that we do for our, like, you know, I advise lots of graduate students who have to write a whole PhD thesis, which is a long amount of work, but you don't try and sit down and write it all at once.
No, no, well, you don't intend to, but people often do the night before, but it's another story. Yeah, so in writing the book, did you, I mean, obviously you're probably quite familiar with most of the content, given that it's your field of expertise, but was there anything you came across where you just suddenly, you know, you just thought, wow, you know, I didn't know this, or whether that was something that's close to your own research or something that's different?
Yeah, no, I did. I found out a lot of new things. There were some scientific things I found out, which I'll come back to, but the thing that I knew least about, which I really enjoyed finding out about, was the history of the scientists. So lots of the scientists whose names I knew, I didn't know so much of the backstory about how they had, you know, how they'd come to do their science, what their lives were like, you know, where the context of when, how they were working. So that was, a lot of that was really new to me. And again, I'd heard their names and then it was wonderful to go back and I, you know, read their original papers and discover what they were like.
Is there any in particular that stand out right now?
There are, yeah. So, for example, one of them is Henrietta Swan Leavitt, who was working at about 100 years ago, or the turn of the last century. And she was actually, she was part of this group of women who were fascinating to me called the Harvard Computers. Mm-hmm. And they were this group of women astronomers who were working at Harvard College Observatory. And they'd been brought together to study photographic plates of stars. But they were not allowed to operate the telescopes themselves because they were women, which is ridiculous. Yeah. But they were not paid very much either. But they actually made a lot of really important discoveries. They classified stars, and Swan Leavitt discovered this pattern in pulsating stars that told us how bright distant stars were and therefore how far away they are. And it was really important. But, you know, I discovered that, you know, for example, she was deaf, as was another of her colleagues who also made a huge impact, this woman, Annie Jump Cannon.
And did they, at the time, was their work recognised as groundbreaking science?
I think it was recognised as important, but I think they didn't have the recognition overall at the time in the field of how important they had been. Mm-hmm. And they are, it's changing. So, for example, for Leavitt, the pattern that she discovered that relates the how quickly stars pulse to how intrinsically bright they are, it's now increasingly known as Leavitt's Law, whereas it wasn't for many years.
You'll hear the second part of that interview with Jo later in the programme, where she speaks about her own research, as well as her thoughts on the search for life beyond the Earth. She also tackles that age-old question of what's the difference between astronomers, astrophysicists and cosmologists. Sounds like the start to a joke, doesn't it? Now, though, I'm going to hand over the mic to Hamish Johnston and Michael Banks from our news team. They'll be discussing some of the stories making the headlines this week.
Thanks, James. It's Hamish here, and I'm joined by Michael Banks, and we're going to be talking about next-generation colliders, and in particular, the International Linear Collider, or ILC. And I think there were plans afoot, Michael, to build the ILC in Japan, but is that being questioned now?
Well, slightly, yes. The International Linear Colliders had quite a long gestation period. So it was first proposed in around 2009 by a group of international physicists. And then in 2011, Japan kind of was interested or put its interest in hosting the ILC. And since then, not really too much has actually happened. So to make the ILC a little bit more palatable to the Japanese government, physicists kind of tweaked the design a little bit. So initially, the design was for a 30-kilometer linear collider, and this would collide electrons with positrons to mainly study the properties of the Higgs boson in quite a precise way.
And the interesting thing about that, or at least to me, is that it will be lower energy than the LHC. Is that right?
Yeah, so that the energies in the initial design were around 500 GeV, the collision point. But then, as I mentioned then, to make it kind of more palatable and a little bit cheaper for the Japanese government to host, physicists redesigned it slightly to have a lower collision energy. So this would be around 250 GeV. And this also means that the actual collider is slightly shorter. So it's around 20 kilometers. So the kind of latest update with the ILC now is that the Japanese Science Ministry last year, they asked the Science Council of Japan to look into the viability of Japan hosting the ILC. And they released a report in December, which was slightly scathing of the ILC. So it said that in terms of the science, the ILC would be doing quite good science, quite good physics. But it wasn't sure about a number of other things, such as whether the expertise in Japan was there, and also whether there would be enough international support. So it kind of like cast a few doubters on the ILC proposal. And that's being now fed into kind of decision makers in Japan. And the idea there is that there will be a decision in March of whether the government will go ahead with the ILC or not. So we'll have to kind of wait and see for that result to come out. But, you know, there's also a possibility that it might get kicked further down the road as well, and a decision may be postponed.
It's a very interesting time for colliders or future colliders, isn't it? Because the LHC, for example, is shut down at the moment. It's being upgraded in terms of its luminosity. And there have been some plans that have come out of CERN for building an even larger collider that would be much, much bigger than the LHC. But on the other hand, there has been a bit of a brouhaha that's sort of broken out in the press and on the blogs. Zabina Hossenfelder, who's a well-known physics blogger, wrote an opinion piece for the New York Times where she seems to argue against building ever larger colliders. And not surprisingly, there's been a backlash as well. I think Hossenfelder's point is that at the moment, theorists aren't really making solid predictions about, you know, what exists at energies beyond the LHC. And there is a danger, of course, this nightmare scenario that one could build bigger and bigger colliders that collide at higher and higher energies and still see nothing. Is that a worry that that you've picked up in the particle physics community, Michael?
I think there's kind of two things possibly going on here. That is, one kind of step is building an electron-positron machine, which would study the Higgs in great detail, as I mentioned before.
That's a Higgs machine.
A Higgs kind of factory.
Yeah. Higgs factory, that's it, yeah.
I mean, that's kind of cheaper than, the ILC is cheaper than the huge 100-kilometer circuit collider, which is one of CERN's proposals. So I guess the case could be made there that, you know, it is slightly cheaper, that machine. It would be on the order of around $5 billion as opposed to, you know, $15 billion. And there, physicists will be looking more about kind of the precise properties of the Higgs and maybe seeing there's any kind of fluctuations from standard model predictions. And therefore, from there, if there's any kind of glimpses of new physics that could be potentially studied by a proton-proton machine. So whether it's worth building a proton-proton collider for 20 billion, say in the future or in 2050, that might be another question that will rear its head at some point as well.
And then I think, you know, an issue that's come up in the blogs, you know, people who have been blogging about Hossenfelder's article and the responses to it, is that, well, you know, why not? We should build as big a collider as possible because it's, you know, it's a bit like climbing Mount Everest or going to the moon. You know, it's a challenge and it should be done for the sake of doing it. I find it difficult to argue with that because in a sense, that's the spirit of science. But on the other hand, of course, the bigger and bigger you make these colliders, the more and more expensive they get. And there is the argument that that money could be better spent on, you know, let's say 100 smaller projects that are looking for physics beyond the standard model. But I suppose we'll have to wait and see if governments are actually willing to stump up the money. I mean, I think there's a lot of talk that, you know, China is possibly the only country at the moment that would be willing to take on such a huge project. Of course, it would be a very prestigious project for Chinese science. I think you've written about Chinese plans for a collider as well, haven't you?
That's right, yeah, the China Electron Positron Collider. That's a proposal from the Institute of High Energy Physics in Beijing. And that's also similar to what the CERN's plans with the future circular collider are, very similar designs in terms of the energies and what they potentially could find. So yeah, as you say, we'll have to wait and see whether governments opt for whichever project.
Yeah, it's a very interesting time for particle physicists. And I do understand, you know, when a particle physicist reads an op-ed piece in the New York Times saying that big colliders shouldn't be built, they could get upset. But I suppose that debate has to happen, but both in public and in the scientific community. And it'll be very interesting to see how it pans out.
So we've got some other headlines this week. So Hamish, you have something about lightning.
Yeah, this is an article that's written by a regular contributor, James Tyrrell. And the thing is, as the planet warms and people tend to congregate in cities, human exposure to lightning hazards is increasing. There's evidence that points to a concentration of lightning strikes around major urban areas compared to their rural surroundings. And it's estimated that about 55% of the world's population live in cities, and by 2050, this could be as high as two-thirds. Now, this research was done by Yoav Yair of the Interdisciplinary Center at Herzliya in Israel. And James's article is called Increased Lightning Hazard Almost Guaranteed.
And what about this fascinating material that seems to get stronger, like real muscles?
Yeah, we've got an article about a new material that increases in strength in response to mechanical stress. And that, you know, that's much like your muscles when you're training at the gym. The scientists who have developed this say it could be used to make fatigue-free structures for a host of industrial applications. Now, it's made from a double network of hydrogels that are designed to self-repair the damage that occurs when tensile forces are applied. Now, this work was done by Takehiro Matsuda of Hokkaido University in Japan. And he says this is the first demonstration in the world of a synthetic material improving its properties thanks to supplied nutrients in a way that's similar to the process of muscle growth. And that's described in an article called Hydrogel Material Flexes Its Muscles. That's by our very own Belle Dumais.
And also a story about diagnosing dementia.
Yeah, there's an article about using PET scans to help diagnose different types of dementia. And that's describing research that was done here in the UK at the Wolfson Molecular Imaging Centre and the Sir Peter Mansfield Imaging Centre. We already know that the PET tracer florbetapir can be used to detect amyloid fibrils associated with Alzheimer's disease. But currently, diagnosing other disorders, such as frontotemporal dementia, requires a separate scan using the metabolism-sensitive tracer FDG. In this latest study, researchers showed that florbetapir can also help diagnose patients with frontotemporal dementia, and this removes the need for a separate scan, which can cause significant stress in such patients. That is described in an article by one of our student contributors, Liam Stubbington, and it's headlined, PET Tracer Offers Dual Diagnosis.
And there's been some new results in laser fusion. Can you tell us some more about that?
Yes. Inertial confinement fusion experiments have been improved by a new computer algorithm that analyzes statistical correlations between previous results. Now, laser fusion blasts tiny pellets of hydrogen isotopes with intense laser pulses. The idea is that you get the nuclei to fuse together and release huge amounts of energy. These experiments have yet to reach ignition, whereby the fusion releases enough energy to cause even more nuclei to fuse in a self-sustaining reaction. Now, a team from the University of Rochester in the US has created a computer program that has analyzed around 80,000 experimental results from their Omega laser facility. The idea is that the program learns the best way to do it from previous results and suggests future experiments. Now, using one of the suggestions from the program, which the team described as very odd or strange, something that they would never think of, they managed to triple the energy yield at the Omega facility. The researchers hope that this algorithm could be used to achieve ignition in future experiments, especially at the National Ignition Facility in California, which is a much larger laser fusion experiment. You can read more about that in Laser Fusion Output is Tripled by New Computer Algorithm, and that's by our regular contributor, Tim Wogan.
Okay, thanks Hamish and thanks Michael. So up next, I'm joined by Mateen Durrani and Sarah Tesh to speak about the February issue of Physics World, as well as the winners of our Christmas jumper competition.
So thanks, James. So here we are, me and Sarah. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
So we've got three main features in the February issue of Physics World. Sarah, do you want to talk about two of them, and then I'll come back to the one that's on the cover for this month?
Yes, of course. So we have two other features, first of which is a feature with more of an industry angle, commissioned by our industry editor, Margaret Harris, and it is on materials that can have two functions in an electric car. So they could act as both a battery and actually the structure of the car. So that's written by Natasha Shershova at Durham University. And for those who want to have a read of it, it's called Structural Supercapacitors. In contrast, we also have a feature on Oumuamua, which is the interstellar object which has caused a large amount of controversy in the astronomy community. You might have seen it on the news. People have debated whether it's an asteroid, a comet, or even an alien probe. So we have Andrew Glester having a look at all the different angles, and that one is called Visitor from Another Star, if you want to take a look at it.
Thanks, Sarah. And yeah, the third feature, which is on the cover of Physics World, is all about the periodic table of elements. And this year, we're celebrating the 150th anniversary of Dmitri Mendeleev, the Russian scientist, hand-drawing the very first periodic table. Now, if you go back and look at that first table, it was very different to the one we know and love today. It was hand-drawn, and it had only about 63 elements, which was all that was known at the time. And there were several question marks indicating elements that were yet to be discovered. And turns out Mendeleev was so confident of his table that those four elements were duly discovered over the years to come. So the features by Physics World's regular columnist, Bob Kreese, who's from Stony Brook University in New York. And he's a historian and philosopher of science, and he's looked back at some of the history of the periodic table. And what his angle on the article is, why there are basically thousands of different periodic tables that people have drawn over the years. So he's looking at the reasons why one particular table is the one that we you see in chemistry textbooks and why you see it in chemistry labs around the world. Why is it that there's one particular table and all these other ones have kind of passed by the wayside? So he looks at that. I quite enjoyed editing that feature because I didn't know much about the history of the periodic table. One thing I've discovered is that, here's a quiz question, Sarah, and I know we've discussed in the office, how many elements only have one letter in their name?
Ooh, I'm going to say 10. That's my guess.
It is 14.
Ooh,
and
close,
I'll let
close.
Listeners work out what they are. And also the other thing I found out at the periodic table, there are 22 elements that only have one isotope. So, or is it 26? It's not a very big number, and there doesn't seem to be any particular rhyme or reason why there are only 26. So there you go. And the title of that feature, for those interested, is An Unelementary Affair. And you can read that in the latest issue of Physics World, and it's also on physicsworld.com. So those are the three cover features. And the other thing we wanted to talk about, Sarah, was our Christmas jumper competition, which you talked about on a podcast
In December. In Christmas.
And do you want to remind listeners about what that was all about?
So in December, we launched a competition asking you guys to design physics-themed Christmas jumpers or sweaters. We had some great entries come in, and we have picked our final five winners who will each receive Stephen Hawking's final book called Brief Answers to the Big Questions. So
there's quite an interesting story, isn't there, Sarah, between the five winners that we picked. We got quite a few entries, as you say, and there were sort of five, but they all had slightly different stories to each of them. So in no particular order, the first winner we picked was Samuel Rhind from the Institut d'Optique in Paris and Alexander Darroux from the Technical University of Vienna. And they had, well, do you want to describe their Christmas jumper, Sarah?
So they did this beautiful Christmas jumper saying, deck the halls with parts of chargers. And it depicts some Christmas trees with some electrons spinning across it. And it's all in the form of a kind of graph thing. And they also went as far as writing a paper about it, which they entitled Seasonal Quantum Hall Effect, to give you a taster of the paper. The abstract goes like this. The seasonal quantum Hall effect has been decking the halls with parts of charges in seasonal synchronization roughly during the entire month of December. Being a global event, here we show that jolliness levels raised to unprecedented highs during this period, which is demonstrated by holiday cheer spectroscopy. It features some wonderful acronyms. So we've got sidereal axis neglecting of tropical areas, aka the Santa effect. It discusses how a lot of this is due to exceedingly attractive physicists wearing measurably stylish and scientifically relevant sweaters. And we also have a reference to a textbook entitled Energetic Gravitational Grouped Novas Originating Gas Cloud, or eggnog. So it's a very chucklesome paper.
Chucklesome, is that a word?
But it is now.
You can tell they were real keen physicists. Now, not all of the winners went as far as writing a paper, but the next winner, she actually knitted the jumper, which was pretty impressive.
Yeah, so that was Kate Blackham, and she is from Milton Keynes. She is doing a part-time long-distance astronomy master's at Swinburne University in Australia. But in the meantime, she works in STEM publishing. And she not only knitted the jumper, but she chose physics-themed yarn to do it as well. So the sparkly background is in a yarn called Starlight, and the pulsars are in Cosmos with Starburst Cosmos Centres. And this all links to the fact that it says the Jingle Bell Bonnell.
So that's a pun on Jocelyn Bell Bonnell.
Yes.
Boom, boom.
Boom, boom, indeed.
And, so the three more winners, the third one was, do you want to say who it was?
So the third winner was Christine Coyne, who is the Assistant Director for Public Affairs at the National High Magnetic Field Laboratory in sunny Florida. So she depicted a magnet with the North and South and Santa at the North Pole, which had us all going, why did we not think of that, we designed our own ones?
That was a pretty good one, wasn't it? In fact, that was one of the first ones that came in, and that really set the bar pretty high.
Yes, it did.
And then what I was really pleased to see, we got there was one particular teacher who got his pupils to enter. So we got quite a few. And who was that, Sarah?
So Mike Viola sent in entries done by his higher physics class, who are 16 to 17 years old. We had a nice batch of entries from them. And our favourite was done by Emma MacDonald, who's a student at the school Dumfries Academy in Scotland. And she depicts the Grinch, and it says, Boar Humbug.
Boar Humbug. Very good. And finally,
your personal favourite.
Well, I don't know. I'm kind of torn between the one with the Santa, actually, and this one. But yeah, this possibly just edged it. So this was Emma Smith in Halifax. And it was a very simple design. It's just red. And what does it say on it, Sarah?
It says, "The Christmas jumper is blue. Brackets, if you run fast enough."
So that's a kind of redshifted joke.
Yes. And Emma Smith is based in Halifax, UK, like you said. And she is a medically retired NHS nurse who really enjoys physics and is actually looking to take it on now as in higher education, now that she is retired.
Brilliant. So, yeah, thanks, Sarah. And it sounded like, you know, those readers who sent in their own Christmas jumpers, it was a really good cross-section of, the people out there. So
yes.
Thanks, everyone. And there are going to be some disappointed people who didn't win. Do you think we'll do it again next year? Or we'll come up with another competition?
We'll come up with another competition.
Maybe we've been and done that. So, so you've written about this, Sarah, on physicsworld.com on the blog channel.
Yes.
So people can go and read and look at the winners there if they want to.
Yes, and thank you everyone who entered. We were really impressed by the designs and also the wide variety of people who entered. It was brilliant, thank you.
Okay, thanks guys. And if you haven't seen them already, I'd highly recommend you check out those jumper designs online. And I'll share a link to the article with them on the podcast pages. Right, so let's return now to that interview with cosmologist Jo Dunkley. We join it again with Jo speaking about her own research, studying data from the Atacama Cosmology Telescope in Chile.
So right now I use a telescope in the north of Chile to look at as far out in space and back in time as you can. So there's this cool thing that the further you look out in space, the further back in time you see, because light takes time to reach us. And I actually look at light that's been coming from pretty much the Big Bang itself. It's like sort of beyond where all the stars are. It's from before there were any stars. The kind of light is microwave light. So it's this very faint, diffuse microwave light that's kind of all around us. And the best place on Earth to go, one of the best places on Earth to go and measure it, it's from the north of Chile, from the Atacama Desert. So we're using one now. It's called the Atacama Cosmology Telescope. We're trying to check how fast the universe is growing at the moment. That's
Just a small task.
Yeah. There's this controversy right now because there's actually two different measurements that have been made and they don't quite agree. Mm. So we're trying to check one of those.
So you're sort of looking for hints of the history of the early universe within this. It's a cosmic microwave background.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. So
yeah.
So with that, are you effectively testing different theories as to how the universe evolved in those early stages?
That's right, yeah. And we test, and so we're looking back to a time when the universe was very young, and we kind of take, it's kind of like we have an image of the universe at that time. And by looking at the image, we compare it to our theories of what we expect different universes to look like. So kind of one of my jobs is to generate, you know, lots of alternative theoretical universes in my computer and kind of compare them to what I see in the data. Okay. So like the different universes might have different ages and different contents and weigh a different amount and stuff.
I really liked at the end of your book, you look forward to some of the big things we can look forward to over the coming years. So you mentioned actually observing a supernova as it happens within our galaxy.
Perhaps
talk about that. And also if there's anything else that you're particularly excited about over the coming generation.
Yeah, so there's this thing, so supernovae are exploding stars. It's what we know will happen at the end of the life of very massive stars, ones that are bigger than our sun. So our sun won't explode at the end of its life. It's not big enough. But any stars that are a bit bigger than our sun, when they run out of fuel at their center, their hydrogen at their core, they will explode, you know, after billions of years or even shorter time. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so they briefly will outshine a whole galaxy of stars. And so we can see them in very distant galaxies exploding. But there's this wonderful history of ones actually exploding in our Milky Way galaxy, where they're just briefly for kind of days or weeks, extremely bright. They're maybe as bright as the moon is in the sky. Mm-hmm. And so if we look back in history, there are these kind of stories of, some of them originally called, you know, guest stars that just suddenly appeared in the night sky. And, but we haven't seen one now for hundreds of years. because they don't happen very often.
Yeah, so it's like, I mean, I guess there's obviously an element of it being slightly random, but I mean, roughly on average,
that's
how
right.
often would
we expect like to see one? We'd expect to happen in our galaxy, you know, every century or so. So yes. we are kind of waiting for one. So 400 years ago, there was this big transition, and Galileo was a central figure in this, of working out the Earth was not the middle of the universe. And actually, one of the pieces of evidence for that was these exploding stars that were clearly very, very distant, but that were kind of that were changing. But as an aside, so we know that one's going to happen in our galaxy sometime soon. When it does, we might be able to see it in daytime. It'll be that bright.
Wow!
And so it'll be just exciting, but also an amazing chance to study the physics of them up close, because we'd like to understand actually what happens inside a star that's exploding.
You know, beyond just, I suppose, understanding the life cycle of a star, are there any other, I don't know, big mysteries that might be solved by being able to see that?
Well, we don't know exactly what happens inside these things. One of the things that we've had a handle on just recently is, for example, how the very heavy elements are made. Mm-hmm. So it's always been this, we've never been quite sure exactly how elements like gold and platinum and things that whose atoms are much bigger than, you know, the stuff we're made of, carbon, nitrogen, how they're made. We now think there's sort of two different ways of making these things, in exploding stars and also in colliding stars, neutron stars. Mm-hmm. This is something that we've just known about in the last couple of years, actually.
LIGO.
Exactly, that's right, yeah. But we still don't quite understand what happens just in the exploding stars. So we would like to know how all the heavy elements are made.
So is it that you perhaps need this huge burning ball of gas to basically providing heat over a sustained amount of time? Is that one of the ideas?
It's the heat, and you also need loads of neutrons. And so what happens to these exploding stars is that you end up with this, you've had this core at the middle of them that's got loads and loads of neutrons in it. Mm. And you need to be able to add them onto an atom to make a big enough one.
Wow.
But you did, my other thing that's not my direct research, but I am just waiting in eager anticipation for, is more signs of Earth-like planets around different stars.
So is that because with the James Webb telescope, is it about to be launched? I'm not quite sure. It always seems to be quite close.
2021 is the date right now.
Okay. I mean, I heard one of its things would be to help look for Earth-like planets.
That's right. And there's this big booming. It's actually a huge field right now that won't just be the James Webb, but other telescopes too. That we've gone from 30 years ago, we didn't know if there were any planets around stars in the sky. And now we've found thousands. And our current estimates are that there are probably more planets than there are stars, that probably most stars have solar systems around them, which I think is amazing, right?
Yeah, sir.
So the planets that we've found so far are mostly not so much like Earth, just because of the nature of how they've been found. Some of them like go around their stars incredibly quickly. Mm. Some of them are like big Jupiter-like planets. But for example, just recently, this new solar system was found. It's called TRAPPIST-1, and it's seven rocky planets around a star only 40 light years from us, which is still pretty far, but it's one of the closest stars to us. And that's, for example, one of the systems that will be studied more carefully by James Webb, and also by other dedicated satellites. There's plans for telescopes and satellites to specifically go after.
Now, are we getting close to the point where we could start to build profiles and start to, you know, obviously not be able to see in detail, but start to infer things about the surface?
The thing that will be that's of interest certainly will be to look at the atmosphere. One of the ways we find these planets is that they go round as they transit in front of their star, and so the planet passes in between the observer and the star. The light from the star gets slightly dimmed when the planet goes past, and that's how we find them. But if you then split the light from the star up into its different wavelengths, the light from the star has gone through the planet's atmosphere to get to the observer. And so you can tell by looking at which wavelengths are kind of missing.
Yeah, look for the gaps.
You can get look for the gaps and see what elements are in the atmosphere.
Are we looking? Would it be carbon or what?
Actually, the kind of thing. So you might want to look for oxygen or ozone, basically byproducts of life that might produce signatures that there are some particular signatures that would naturally be, not there wouldn't be so much of them if there wasn't life producing, you know, forms to sustain them.
Yeah. Cool. Wow. So those exoplanets and
exploding stars
are the two big exciting things for you.
Yeah. Well, I think that's only two of the things. Yeah. I want to find dark matter. That's one of my things.
You might be winning a Nobel Prize if you do. I had one final question. It was actually from a colleague, Hamish. He wants to know the difference, in your opinion, between an astronomer, an astrophysicist, and a cosmologist. It might be something you've had before, this question.
Do you know what? I even write about this in my book, actually. So, because it's a very common question, because it's this mixture of names. I think of an astronomer as someone who studies the skies and tries to understand what's going on out there. A physicist is someone who asks questions about, you know, the laws of how things work. And, you know, an astrophysicist applies that to things in space. So, for example, I think an astrophysicist is someone who will want to really understand the workings of things they see in space. Mm-hmm. I mean, astronomers in general want to do that too, but you know, maybe more generically, they're you know, observing space and making sense of it.
Yeah, there's probably some crossover.
There's a definite crossover. There's huge crossover. We have all our departments in this. It's a massive crossover. We don't really know what to call ourselves usually. But cosmology, I think of as a branch of astronomy, because it's the branch that asks the questions about the broad scale properties of the universe. So I think of it as part of astronomy because you do it by looking at the skies and try to make sense of what's out there. But the questions you ask are questions about the large scale properties. How old is it? What's in it on average?
Just by its nature, I guess, would you say cosmology sometimes sort of spreads into philosophy as well? I mean, did you see, how would you describe the difference to a layperson between a cosmologist and a philosopher?
Well, so I think to me, I think it becomes philosophy if it's asking questions that you can't test the answer to. So to me, the thing that I do is to ask questions about the universe that I can then go and test with data. Mm-hmm. And that in itself, I think, has changed perhaps in cosmology over the years or centuries, that perhaps we'll still have in their minds that cosmology is, you know, thinking about the bigger picture of where we are without actually, you know, testing it with data. But it's now a strongly data-driven field. We look at the skies.
Probably more than people realise, actually. You need all the computing power that's needed to process all that data.
That's right. And it's data-driven, as in it's we're not coming up with ideas. We're actually testing those ideas.
Yes.
And so I think if there's a question that then becomes untestable, to me that goes more into philosophy, although there are obviously other overlapping parts too. But for example, you know, there are things we can ask about, you know, are we part of some you know, multiverse where there's many other universes, you know, separated from ours, and maybe there's a way to test some of those theories, and then to me that becomes more into my realm. Mm-hmm. But some of those are questions that I don't think we'll ever be able to answer, and they're interesting. But I don't think of them as part of my job.
Great. Okay, well, yeah, thanks for your time today, Joe. Thanks for joining us.
Sure.
And good luck with the talk this evening and the rest of the tour.
Thank you.
Okay, well, thanks for listening today. And if you enjoy what you hear, then don't forget, you can also check out our other podcast called Physics World Stories. Presented by Andrew Glester, that podcast takes a more in-depth look at specific areas of physics. And you can subscribe to both of those podcasts via all the major podcast apps. Join us again next week. Bye.
Physics World.